Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, March 20th, 2007 Carrboro Board of Aldermen regular business meeting. We'll begin our meeting, as we always do for regular business meetings, with requests from visitors and speakers from the floor. Is there anybody who is here to speak on a matter that is not already on our printed agenda? If not, let's move on to the consent agenda, Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item 1 is approval of minutes of the previous meeting on March 6th. Item 2 is a request to dispose of the house on the MLK Junior Park property by private sale. Item 3 is a request to set a public hearing for the permanent closing of the Todd Street right-of-way. Item 4 is appointment to the Appearance Commission. Item 5 is award of contract for the Bowling Creek Watershed Study. Item 6, additional appointments to the Smith Level Road Task Force. And item 7 is a request to approve a budget amendment for facilitation services from the Dispute Settlement Center.
Who are the items?
I'd like to pull number 3.
The closing of the Todd Street right-of-way?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll take that as a motion for the...
All the 3.
6 items other than number 3. It's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Agenda item, let's proceed to item 3.
Item number 3, which is a permanent closing of the Todd Street right-of-way. The reason that would be done would be to then give the property or let the property be used by the people who are building there, who are building condos there. There was some concern when there was a joint review of this, of why is the town giving property away? And, you know, if they want that property, what's that property worth? And maybe we should, instead of giving it to them, sell it to them. So
that's Mr. Manager or Attorney, is that a possibility?
The short answer is I don't know for sure. I know that there's the process of closing the street, which we have used on a number of occasions, and is the one that's being proposed here. I'm not aware. I know that we've never charged anyone to do it, and I don't think the statute makes any provision for selling right away. It doesn't say you can't. It just doesn't have a specific provision for doing that. I think. That's about all I can tell you on it.
May I respond to that?
Please do.
Maybe not sell it, but I think it's certainly valuable, and the property that is under discussion cannot be further developed without it, in the way that they want to develop it. So I think that puts us in a position where we can request things like highly energy efficient buildings. Make sure that there's adequate moderate and low-income housing included. But I just don't think we should go giving away.
Well, let me... Could I ask...
Yes.
Are you sure it's not the Barn Street project?
Excuse me. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure.
No. Okay. I mean, you're right. Yeah.
It is the Barn
Street.
She
is thinking of Barn Street.
Yeah.
And you're talking about Todd Street. But let me ask a different question as long as we're on.
Same issue, though.
Yeah.
Same
it
issue.
Kind of is, except that I don't think there's a proposal to build anything more on Todd Street. Is that right? So can I get some clarification? What portion of the Todd Street right-of-way would be abandoned? All of it?
George, I think we have a map.
I'd be highly embarrassed, but it's not the first time that I was publicly confused, so I'm not,
That's just what Marty was whispering. You thought it might be Barn Street.
I thought that's what he was.
But it's still...
Well, let me... I'm headed a different place with it, but it's a similar issue. So
I believe there's a... I believe there's a map within your packet, but basically the current right-of-way is 46 feet wide and approximately 590 feet long, and yes, the answer is all of it. That's the existing right-of-way.
Who owns the property just beyond the end of the right-of-way?
That's the school.
So right now, school kids can walk down the public right-of-way that is Todd Street and cut through the woods and get to the school.
They currently do that, I believe, yes.
But if we abandon that as a public right-of-way, then the land would belong to Todd Street LLC, Todd Street TS LLC, whatever.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So it would be then up to them to decide whether they were going to let people cut down that driveway and access the school that way by foot.
I guess it could be, yes. There is a fence that's on the school property currently.
Yeah, but the fence is built with a couple of gaps in it so that you can cut through.
Well, and it's on the school property, yes.
I guess I'm not unalterably opposed to this, but I'm not ready to vote for it tonight.
This is just to set the public hearing, just as a reminder.
This is to set a public hearing on the matter.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm willing to have a public hearing.
But with the idea that...
That's one of the issues that we're going to need to hear from the public about. There's some negotiation that can go on.
The statute does provide, I have to go get it in a minute, but the statute, I know the statute provides for the reservation of various kinds of easements, including utility easements. I don't know whether it's specific to them or just says easements. I will check that, and in which case, you know, if you choose to close it, you could do it. And cities often do that, subject to retaining certain rights for public easements of various kinds.
Right.
So that, I mean, that's, it's not an either-or situation, in other words.
Okay. Well, we'll I'm sure get to hear more about that at the public hearing. All right. So, is there a motion to set a public hearing on this matter?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously.
Thanks, George.
Item D1, presentation by Signal, the Southeast Electronic Music Festival. Mr. Manager.
The purpose of this item is to introduce and present to the Board of Aldermen Signal, the Southeast Electronic Music Festival, which will be seeking some financial support from the board in the 08-09 budget, which obviously is year after next. Edward Williams III is here. He has a brief presentation for the board. Edward.
Come on up to this microphone right here, if you would.
Good evening. Thank you for seeing us and having some fun here this evening. I'd like to recognize the economic director, thank him for his support and guidance. One of the folks that contributes to fear of public speaking being a far greater concern than the fear of death, so forgive me for my lack of clarity. The Southeastern Electronic Music Festival is something that we started up last year. We had about 1,500 people come into Chapel Hill and Carrboro, used a lot of the local venues, and tried to serve three purposes. The first was to give a lot of local talent, DJs, live musicians, and music producers, the chance to share stage with regional, national, and international talent. We're doing the same thing again this year. And we're going to have 3 days of workshops, discussions on UNC campus, and live performances in a lot of the local venues. What we'd like to do is expand this even further. As far as marketing goes, we've been advertising and will continue to advertise in things like the News and Observer, the Independent, Daily Tar Heel, and several national and international electronic music magazines. Give you kind of an idea of the response that we've been getting. Last month, we had about 42,000 hits on one of our websites and about 28,000 hits on the second of our websites. So we're anticipating quite a big crowd, and we certainly hope to be contributing a lot to town coffers by way of the local restaurants, nightclubs, bars, and hotels, and so forth. What we would like to do with the town of Carrboro is, as we've already been put in touch with the folks coordinating the Carrboro Music Festival, we'd like to go ahead and form some kind of partnership with them, kind of work alongside them, and we certainly hope to be a part of the Carrboro Music Festival this fall. We feel that the events are somewhat complementary as they address somewhat different target audiences, but definitely have a cross-pollination and share many of the same target demographics. What we'd like to do is to ask the town of Carrboro for sponsorship participation, and again, the 2008-2009 budget. They've included in the little green pamphlet that you guys got there. There should be a write-up, some marketing materials from 2006, and also a little bit of a description of what we're doing this particular year, and then the way that our sponsorship levels work and so forth. I'm not sure if there are absolutely any questions whatsoever. Hopefully you guys had a chance to take a quick peek at the materials. And I'd love to answer absolutely any and all questions about what we're kind of going for, what we've done in the past, and what we hope for this year, or anything like that.
Will you send us announcements when the event takes place this year?
So absolutely, most assuredly.
See the real thing.
Absolutely. What we've done, again, last year, it was only about 1,500 people, but we're hoping for about five times that many this year. I think that it's well within reason and potentially far more than that. So I would absolutely love to follow up with you all and present some follow-up marketing, specific numbers, the numbers from the venues here in town, Cat's Cradle, 506, Open Eye Cafe, and the like. So I'd most assuredly do that.
Don't really have any questions. It's a great event. And you're not requesting funding in this current budget year.
No, sir.
But so this is just to ask for the town's endorsement. So
absolutely.
You know, unless people have other questions, I would move that the town welcomes the Signal Music Festival and just to offer to direct our economic development director to work and assist with and assist you in any way possible, as he already has been. But it's always helpful to James to have our little stamp of approval.
Gotcha. Well, I certainly do appreciate
keep working with you.
Gotcha. Fantastic.
I had a question about where on the UNC campus are these events?
We're going to be in the three largest meeting halls on campus. So they're going to be actually in classrooms and lecture halls. Yes, ma'am.
All right. So, and it's April 26th through 28th?
That is correct. Yes.
So
I'm going to invite you all to attend. If any of you have absolutely any inkling whatsoever to come and see some of the little workshops or the discussions, I would absolutely love to have you. So by all means, let me know. You should have contact information for me there.
Cool. Would it be very hard for Andy to put a link on, you know, an appropriate page on our website to
connect to it?
To yours.
Cool. I would absolutely love that.
So maybe we could ask Andy to and James to look into
get
that.
The information, we can talk to Andy about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. So that's a motion.
I'll second.
Great. It's been moved and seconded. And all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Cheers.
Matter passed unanimously. Thanks a lot for coming.
Well, and, absolutely. Thank you all
I
for having
really
me.
I have to really compliment you on the professional quality of the material. So I look forward to checking out the event.
Fantastic. Thank you again.
All right.
I want to thank you for coming.
All right. Item two, report from Chapel Hill Transit Operations Plan.
Steve Spade, the Director of Transportation for Chapel Hill Transit, will make a presentation on current operations and plans for upgrades and improvements. And there's a resolution in the board's packet receiving the report as provided. And Steve has made his way to the podium. Steve.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor and Alderman, for inviting me tonight. I'd like to, if I can figure out how to use the overhead, use that for just a moment. I prepared some information for the for the Chapel Hill Town Council, and you have a copy of that information in your packet. I hope you can use that as some background information or as a status report on where we are. What I'd like to do is briefly hit some highlights on that and be happy to answer any questions. Specifically, what I thought I might do is talk a little bit about how we assess where we are today and then talk about some of the priority issues that we've got coming up in the future. One of the things that I thought you might be interested in is the peer group comparison that we recently completed. What we tried to do in our system is compare ourselves to other transit systems, both in the state of North Carolina and nationally. And when we measure the way our systems perform, we look at several key factors. Ridership per capita, which is the number of riders you have annually divided by the passengers, it really shows you, or by their population, which gives you a sense of the kind of support and usage you have community-wide to your system. And then productivity and efficiency, financial measurements of passengers per mile, passengers per hour, and then cost factors of cost per passenger, cost per mile, and cost per hour. When we compared ourselves, we tried to do two things. First, we compared ourselves to our peers in the state of North Carolina. And out of over 100 transit systems in the state, we selected four others that are close as we could get in terms of demographics and size of the system. And those were Durham, Greensboro, Raleigh, and Winston-Salem. They also then did a comparison to transit systems nationally, which I think is probably a little more appropriate for us. Chapel Hill is a community of about 90,000 people, and a good portion of our population is made up of University of North Carolina. So what we tried to do on a national basis is identify cities that have a major university and criteria similar to what we've got. And we selected eight cities to compare ourselves in that study, and those were Champaign-Urbana, Athens, Georgia, Ann Arbor, Michigan, State College, Pennsylvania, UC Davis, and obviously I've forgotten the Gainesville, Florida, I think was another one. I'll show you those in a minute. What I'd like to do just quickly is walk you through these. By way of summary, what I would say is that if you look at the way we compared other transit systems in North Carolina, you'll find out that our performance is head and shoulders above everybody else. We're by far not the largest city or system in the state in terms of population, but we are the second largest transit system in the state and dwarf many of the others. This first chart shows the Chapel Hill ridership compared to the other four systems in North Carolina. You can see that at 5.4 million, we're quite a bit above the others. The next chart down is our passengers per revenue mile, which is another way that we measure how productive we are in our system. And you can see that we're at 2.96 when the median is about 1.75. Again, if you look at cost per mile, well, let's take a look at passengers per hour. And again, every time we look at the number of passengers we carry, you'll see that we're more productive than our neighbors in the state. When you look at cost per boarded passenger, the local governments are paying about $1.61 in subsidy each time somebody gets on the bus, compared to, for instance, Greensboro, where they're paying $2.98 every time somebody gets on the bus, and that excludes the fare being paid for the passenger. So the average cost in this community for somebody to ride the bus is about a third of what that is in comparable systems. And I think that says something about what the fare-free system accomplishes. Again, in terms of cost per mile, and this is our ability to maintain costs and be competitive, you'll see that even though we're more productive, that our cost factors are very comparable to the rest of the state. So what we're doing isn't costing any more in terms of cost per hour, cost per mile, than it is in other systems across the state. Passengers per capita is kind of an interesting factor. You'll see that we carry 77, almost 78 passengers per capita in the system. The closest system to that in North Carolina is Durham, that carries 21 passengers per capita. So again, far greater community support and involvement in the transit system than you see other places in North Carolina. When you start to compare us nationally with other systems that are similar, you start to see a little difference. We're not head and shoulders above everybody else, but we are real comparable to what the other university systems do. We carry 5.39 million passengers, but you'll see Champaign-Urbana, Madison, Wisconsin, which really isn't comparable because of the size of their city. They're about 200,000. I threw that in there because we happened to visit there this year. Athens, Georgia, and University of Michigan do have a higher ridership than we do, and systems that are fairly similar. When you look at passengers per mile, again, we are right at the median, about 2.96, but there are some cities, systems like Athens, Georgia, that are far above the median and really set the standard. Athens, Georgia, by the way.
Yes. I just wanted to interject a point, which is I'm thinking the ones you mentioned are universities that have considerably larger student bodies than we do, which would, of course...
Most of them are. I think most of them are larger. They're 30, 35,000 and maybe 40, even a little larger.
Madison, 40. Is upwards of 40.
Right. Yep. Yeah, the comparison isn't perfect, but it gives us a sense of where we're doing well and maybe not where we're not doing so well. Again, when you look at our passengers, we're about at the mean in passengers per hour at 36, while places like Athens, Georgia, and Champaign are far above where we are. Cost per passenger, again, we are a little below the mean at $1.61, and you'll see where some of the others are. And the same thing holds true with our cost per mile. Again, I'm going through these kind of quickly, but again, our cost per hour, we're right about the mean, kind of the middle of the pack. But when you look at our passengers per capita, and this gets back to your point, Dan, and that's that we are, again, when you look at the ridership we've got for the population base that we've got, we're as productive or doing as well as anybody else. What this tells us is that we've got a very, very strong ridership base, which is probably no surprise to any of you, but the other thing it says to us is that in terms of the way we're doing our job from a financial management standpoint, we're not doing too bad. We're hanging in there. We're providing service at the same cost per mile and same cost per hour as others. We think there are some areas that we can improve on, and that's what we want to try to do is maintain our cost figures and stay competitive, but see if we can improve those performance numbers so that we actually match up better against our peers. Just a note now on, I think, in the past year, I've been here just about a year now, and as we've been preparing this budget, we've looked back at some of the challenges we've had, and we think that we've made some big inroads in some of our issues. I think a year ago we had service quality issues, issues of fleet modernization and getting to full staff. In the past year, we have completed a fleet modernization plan, got a commitment from the partners to move ahead on a purchase of 19 vehicles and actually have 19 new buses coming in this year. That's a complete change in what we've done before. They're a low floor, more accessible bus, larger capacity. We'll have 3 60-foot articulated buses here this summer that we'll be able to use on high ridership routes. So we'll be able to experiment with doing some different kinds of service delivery. We're finally at full staff. When I got here, I think we were short 20 operators and probably 5 or 6 people in our maintenance department. We're now at full staff, which is allowing us to, I think, do a better job of service delivery. Last year, we had trouble just getting the buses on the street. I think our people do a very good job with the fleet that we've got of meeting those demands. As I look at the development of next year's budget, I think the big challenge that we have is in the area of continuing to improve on service delivery and then also focusing on our maintenance department and our maintenance activities. We've recommended in this budget that we need to increase the number of mechanics we have on staff. If you do the same peer group analysis and you take a look at the number of buses and the number of buses per mechanic, we should have about 5 more mechanics on staff to perform preventative maintenance, repair activities, and things like that. So we're hoping that over a couple of years we can get that number up where we can provide a better service. Also, we think that we ought to be able to improve in the area of public information and marketing. It's very important for us. In some of our research, we found that about 39% of our ridership turns over every year between students and new staff at the university and university hospitals, and there needs to be a constant flow of good, reliable, accurate information to people. So those are two areas, I think, that are a real focus for us as we move into the budget next year. I've tried to briefly hit some of these topics. If you've had a chance to review that information, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
These are relatively minor, but from a quality of ridership experience, they're kind of important. It may cost some money, but in the overall scheme of what it costs to run the transit system, probably not. It would be great, and I would like to request, that we have, if not at every, then at more of the stops, schedules, accurate schedules. I don't think there's a stop in Carrboro that has schedules on it, that has accurate schedules on it. And that really makes a difference in people riding the bus. Mm-hmm. The new electronic boards are really neat. They seem to still have some gremlins in them. And I know I'm not unique in this. I was at one the other day, and it said that the next J would be there in 25 minutes, and so I can walk home quicker than that. And so it's probably a good thing because I should have been walking home instead of taking the bus anyway. But 3 minutes later,
the J bus
comes by, you know. So that I'm sure it's really hard to get that to operate perfectly. But I can see where I was happy I was forced to walk, but I can see where some people, it would be kind of frustrating. But having more schedules at more bus stops, particularly in Carrboro, I think is, and accurate schedules, is really, it's a small thing, but I think it would help. But thank you for all the work you've been doing, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. We have a bid out for schedule holders to put on bus stops throughout the community. Our goal is over the spring and summer to hit at least all of the time points in the system that you see in the transit guide so that they'll have accurate information.
What do you mean, just a place where people can pull a brochure?
No, it will actually be, right now they tape them on the inside of the shelter windows, which looks tacky.
And we don't have that many shelters.
And
anyway,
when you go to replace them, then it's high maintenance because you got to figure out how to clean the glass and eventually end up replacing the glass. So what we're purchasing are 8.5 by 11 metal and plexiglass holders that will screw into the side of the bus stop or the shelter, and we'll be able to just go in and change a piece of paper.
So even like just the bus stops that don't have a shelter that simply have a metal sign?
You just put two screws in the channel iron.
Wonderful.
And you're done. Our goal is that every time point would have the time the bus is scheduled to be at that point. Your point on next bus is well taken. We do have a few gremlins. Some of them are in the operating system, and some of them are in getting the drivers to remember to log on to get the system up.
It should be hard to remember a new thing.
And the other thing is that just the way our operation is set up today is we only have one computer screen for our dispatchers to look at. When we've moved to the new building, the real-time bus information will always be displayed in front of the dispatchers so they'll know when somebody's off and be able to log them on. So
great.
That next bus system gets 2,000 hits a day online.
Really?
Which is third largest in the nation for the next bus clients. And next bus has like San Bernardino and San Francisco and some large clients. But again, our ridership base really uses that system, which I have to tell you, when I first saw it, I thought it's going to be a great management tool, but it's a much more significant public information tool than I originally thought it would be. Mm-hmm. So we really do need to keep it accurate.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I use it.
Yeah, a lot of people do.
Board members?
We've received a report.
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passed unanimously.
Thank
Thanks
you.
A lot, Steve.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Manager, item 3, request set a public hearing on land use ordinance text amendment to establish urban amenity space requirements for development in downtown.
So, this is merely a request.
Request
to
set
so
public hearing rather
so
than a
so
public
we don't
hearing.
Need a yeah. long
yes,
discussion.
Yeah, this is not the public hearing. But we do have a draft ordinance that's been prepared, and Kendall is at the podium to give you all a brief presentation on the proposal, and the hearing date is proposed to be for April 24th. Kendall?
Thank you. Okay, this is a story of how
downtown livability area and urban amenities may be born in the town of Carrboro. A little background first is the current land use ordinance requires a 40% set aside of land area for open space in for residential properties, and that includes in the downtown area. In 2005, the B1F and Overlay District Subcommittee was looking at this and looking at the scarcity of land, the expense of land, and so forth, and also visioning what enhancements could be made to the downtown area. And they made recommendations proposing civic space and civic amenities. Advisory boards reviewed this proposal last fall, and in January of this year, a group of developers with a representative of Jack Haggerty, and he's here tonight, submitted a text amendment proposing urban amenities instead of open space. So there is some overlap between what the B1F subcommittee recommended and what the recent application envisions. Regarding the process, we were struggling with a number of what seemed to be conflicting town policies in looking at these issues, and so we approached the advisory boards and asked them for very preliminary and formal comments just to guide us in developing a draft ordinance. We have developed a draft ordinance. It's at your table tonight. It's very rough. We still need to do some tweaking. An April 24th public hearing is possible. Just a little bit of review. The open space requirements currently was envisioned for the whole town, and it was not specified just for the downtown, but it did include the downtown, and it was for vistas, relief from urban environment, preservation of special features. There were no amenities required in the open space under the current regs, and the benefits are thought to be to the general public as well as to residents, but the open space is not required to be publicly accessible under the current ordinance. The B1F and Overlay District Subcommittee recommendation called for civic space, and it gives examples here. It's courtyards, pedestrian alleys, social spaces, and civic amenities such as water features, public art, planting beds, and so forth. They did not specify quantification other to say, than to say that a point system might be designed similar to the recreation space point system. The developer's text amendment proposal from this January proposed urban amenities. Again, you'll see some overlap with what the B1F subcommittee recommended. They did provide a formula for assessing the value, and it is tied to the construction cost and the amount of residential square footage on the site, plus the underlying land value. Open space is not required under this proposal, but it could be selected as one possible amenity. And there is an option of a partial payment in lieu for off-site improvements as long as they're within a quarter mile. And I'll come back to this table. This has been expanded since we've drafted an ordinance, so I could hand that out in a minute. Preliminary comments from the advisory boards included that the 40% requirement is too high, but they did want to see some space reserved on the sites, incentivize provision of improvements accessible and visible to the public, provide space and improvements. In other words, provide the space and with the improvements on it, not just space or not just improvements. How to encourage diversity in the type of improvements. In other words, don't want a repetition of just one kind of amenity, property after property. Apply the requirement for improved outdoor space to all downtown developments. This is a more recent addition to the discussion, so not just containing this to residential development, but all downtown development. Improvements on-site are preferable to off-site improvements or payment in lieu. include transportation-related improvements in the list of possible urban amenities and have the proposed improvements be reviewed by an advisory board focused on the visual, cultural, and functional aspects of the improvements in the downtown context. The staff draft attempted to incorporate as many of these suggestions as possible, as well as some of the features of the two proposals. And we came up with a different term, downtown livability area, instead of open space, improved with urban amenities similar to the ones listed in the B1F and the applicant's proposal. The land area requirements would be with incentives for commercial versus residential development, would be incentives for green space and incentives for public access. And then we also looked at the possible option. We're not certain that we would want to include payment in lieu or off-site improvements. This might be an option, though, for unusual circumstances, kind of a relief valve if there's a strange situation or it seems like on-site provision would be unworkable or not appropriate. Also, in the staff draft, it has a scheme that I was telling you about, incentivization of green space and public access. What it shows is, for example, if the development was all to be commercial, it would lower the 40% requirement to 20% requirement of land area with the amenities provided on it, and then further reduction of the land area if it's landscaped or if it's publicly accessible, and then if both enhancements of landscaping and public access are provided, even further reduction of land area. But the amenity value would stay the same. And then as more residential is proposed within a mixed-use development, for example, then the land area requirement goes up. So it's a slight incentive to build commercial in the downtown. The downtown livability area and urban amenities would be land or rooftop area for these various purposes that were expressed in the proposals and include the amenities such as those in the other proposals. I think I'll go to the comparison chart at this point, and we can go into more depth on any of the key issues you would like. Whoops. I'm not doing wrong. Okay, thanks. Okay, so going through this, the open space, well, the different kinds of requirements under the current land use ordinance, the applicant's proposal, the B1F subcommittee recommendation, and the staff's draft. Different terminology on the first line. Open space requirement is required now. Under the applicant's proposal, it would be possible but not required. It's just one of several amenities. The B1F subcommittee recommendation. Whoops. I'm sorry, I gave you the one with my notes on it. Thank you. Let's see. Okay, so, and then a B1F subcommittee recommendation. Again, it's possible but not required. The staff's draft would say livability area instead of open space, and the land area requirement again depends on the kind of use and whether or not it's landscaped or publicly accessible. Recreation facilities.
Is this in our packet?
Actually, I brought the handouts and I can pass them around to you. Sorry.
Yeah, it's missing a comma. I think you're looking at the one without the staff pass.
Just one page, Brenda?
Yes.
Thanks.
One is blank, if you could. Okay. Sorry about, it's kind of small type there.
So this replaces attachment D3?
Yes.
Okay.
For the recreation facilities, again, the land use ordinance requires that for residential development, applicant's proposal, it's possible but not required, in the B1F subcommittee, and we would not propose any changes to the current recreational requirements. There are different formulae for calculating the value of open space. The applicant's proposal would value it at 2 times the land value. The B1F subcommittee recommendation was to create a point system for the amenities. The staff draft would say that for the value, that would only apply if you're doing a payment in lieu. The quantification formula for improvements would be under the applicant's proposal, tied to the land cost and to the square footage of construction and construction cost. The B1F subcommittee recommendation, again, the point system was recommended. The staff draft shows a percentage of the land value, depending on the type of use and whether or not it's landscaped and whether or not it's publicly accessible. The payment in lieu option is possible under all the scenarios, except the B1F subcommittee didn't address that particular issue. Off-site provision is possible under all the proposals in the current land use ordinance.
Can you define the phrase applicable downtown livability area?
Okay, well, that depends on the percentage of, in the scheme that we propose, the 20%, for example, in the all commercial. So it would. I didn't want to put a figure or there because it depends on the kind of use. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
For the market.
Okay. Let's see. Some of the issues we were looking at were, you know, whether or not to keep a percent of land as not built upon. There are some policy statements, for example, in the downtown development guidelines that call for a necklace of green space, and the public feedback we've been getting over the years is to keep the downtown green and walkable. And that needs to be balanced with the scarcity and expense of downtown land and scarcity of green open space and the permanence of hardscape. So we've really struggled with some of these issues. But we note that, that green space enhances the pedestrian comfort and helps with environmental effects, including stormwater management. It's a visual break from the hardscape, and it supports the gathering spaces, social spaces, and so forth. Accessibility to the public, I've gone over the different the comparison table, and I think I can just stop there unless you want to go into depth in some of these key issues we struggled with. Yes.
Dan.
Yeah, I guess, Kendall, my question is kind of a broad one about when you say you need to tweak this more. Let's say we did set a public hearing for April 24th.
Mm-hmm.
How different is what we would see at that public hearing from what's before us tonight? I mean, could you kind of describe
the process? Yes, I can. What we'd like to do is apply some of these numbers, these percentages that we propose, to real-life existing situations and proposed developments and see if it looks like the numbers are appropriate. And then we look at, again, this issue of the payment in lieu and off-site dedication, whether that's something.
Okay, so you may actually fine-tune the numbers a bit.
Right.
And the payment in lieu formula.
Right.
A bit.
Right.
For the draft for the public hearing.
Right, but the structure would be the same and the general scheme of incentives would stay the same.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. A couple challenges I think in this is that it's inherently very complex and frankly kind of opaque. I don't know if there's any way to make it more intuitive in terms of how one understands it looking at it. I mean, it's going to be hard to comply with. It's going to be hard to explain to people. And so, you know, that's probably something that you'll need to work on going forward if we choose to go down this policy road. But I would, you know, I would just sort of ask staff to think about how you're going to do that. Our regulatory structure is inherently complex and in many cases for good reasons, but it's difficult to use. So mm-hmm. So I hope that you can work on that. As well, I support the idea of including a provision allowing for payment in lieu and or offsite provisions. Where we really get trapped and we really get screwed is when we try to think of every circumstance, but there are occasions where it just doesn't apply and just doesn't work, and the applicant gets stuck and we get stuck, and it's embarrassing to us and costly for applicants. So I think it's important to maintain, as you phrased it, I think, well, that safety valve, mm-hmm. if you will, so that we have a mechanism available to apply to situations that we may not have thought of as they arise. That's the only feedback I really have.
Okay. Thank you.
If we have payment in lieu, I'd like it as tightly drawn as possible. I think I think public amenities is drawn broadly enough, or downtown livability amenities is drawn broadly enough, that most people, most developers would be able to come up with something to meet that. And rather than have payment in lieu where they could get out of it, I think we're seeing throughout both towns now, when it comes to housing affordability, we're seeing an awful lot of the off-site payment in lieu being used, which is kind of counter to what we would hope would be happening. And it kind of puts the responsibility on other folks to be providing and to be creating the downtown livability amenities. So if you can afford to pay somebody else to do it, then you pay somebody else to do it, rather than being forced to provide something on site, which makes for a much more interesting downtown. So I can see where we would want some kind of safety valve, but I would want us to have it a true safety valve and not just an easy opt-out.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Kendall, I think this is looking really good. And between the first pass and now, it's really starting to take some shape. And I really appreciate the work the whole department has done to make this happen.
Thank you.
And the way it's starting to unfold, I think, you know, it's getting much closer to what we're looking for. And I look forward to seeing some samples, because I know when I was looking at the chart and some of the recreational things, I started to wonder how those numbers will shake out. So I think that's going to be very helpful.
Okay.
Thanks.
So I move we go ahead and set the public hearing. Do you think you can get this, like, before we do that? Just given the feedback you've gotten, is that public hearing date still realistic for you guys to finish up?
I think so.
Okay. Then we can go ahead and set that.
Did you make a motion? Yeah. I'll second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded.
Can I ask Mike a question before we go? Mike, if we have the public hearing and then there's some problems that come up with these formulas, say, that we're looking at, how far can we go in changing them without needing to have another public hearing on that? Or?
Well, I mean, you just have to kind of apply a rule of thumb. I think there's certainly the public hearing notice will indicate that substantial changes may be made. And I think if there are changes that are generally reflect, you know, an alternative formula or something like that, I don't think that's a problem. If the kind of the rule of thumb is, you know, if someone looked at this and said, gee, I have no problem with this, but then what you've done, they'd look at that and say, ooh, I'd have a big problem with that. That's kind of the rule of thumb that you'd want to feel like, you know, you'd need to re-advertise. So, you know, if, for example, you advertise a 25% open space and the board decided they wanted to jump that up to 50%, that I would suggest to you that you probably need to re-advertise that. But if you're tweaking the formula, certainly if you're lessening it so it's less onerous, if you will, or less.
But 25 to 30 might be.
I think so. I think we're probably going to hear. I shouldn't presuppose that. We have to look at these numbers and see what these numbers look like in terms of what they actually, how they actually work out. And I think that's going to be an important thing to look at. So I think there's some flexibility there, but it's just if you're going to make major changes that substantially really change the nature of what you're talking about, I think that's when you have to talk about another public hearing. Is it really the same ordinance, or have you really created a different ordinance?
Well, and I think if there's an inclination to make some significant changes to the staff proposal when it's before us at that public hearing, you may want to send it back to the staff to give our attorney and staff a chance to actually draft those changes and put them back before us anyway. So. If you change 25 to 26, that's sort of one thing, but you start to add a whole section or something that's...
I think Michael gives us guidance. I mean, if we start crossing the line into making major revisions, he'll tell us that we need to pull back.
I think I have to do some work on this ordinance. This, you know, we really haven't had a chance to... There's some just drafting things and definitions and stuff and things that have to get tweaked and worked and cleaned up a little bit, but,
I'm favorably disposed toward the general concept of this thing, but I have a feeling that that it's not just going to be about one more conversation about it, and that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. So.
How will this public hearing be advertised?
How would it?
Mm-hmm.
Notice is in the paper. I believe it's twice.
Once a week for two successive weeks, at least 10 days, not more than 25 for the first notice.
And that's because... of of how our rules are written, of how different kinds of public hearings are.
That's a state statute requirement, right, that you have to do, because this is a text amendment. There is no requirement for notice of individual property owners. That's right. Something. You know.
But we will be in regular contact with the developers who have brought this item forward to us.
It's not that I don't like the developers, but the developers aren't the ones I'm worried about, because it really affects everybody downtown. This is a really big deal, and I'd hate to see not enough people aware of what's going on with it. So is there a middle ground between doing mailings of everybody within 1,000 feet? Because I know I can just read Steve's face on that one. and making sure that people, that the residents, not just of downtown, but that of all of Carrboro, know about it, because it's potential for it will affect the face of Carrboro, which is important to everybody. So I want to see it as broadly advertised as we can.
I'm just going to offer my usual caution, which is that anytime we adopt an ordinance section that is sweeping and inherently complex as this, you can be absolutely assured that the first time we actually have to use it, all kinds of issues are going to pop up, and we're going to have to make changes and tweaks, mm-hmm, and address it. So, it's just the nature of the beast. We can't think of everything the first time around.
But it's the people's town.
Yeah,
and they need input in how their town looks.
That's not what I'm talking about.
I know. I understand what you're talking
right.
about.
What I'm talking about is actually some disclosure here, which is to admit that we're not clairvoyant and to admit that we don't have the ability to project every possible exigency.
Right. So we invite people up front before we pass it rather than have the issues.
I don't know what the hell you're arguing about, because I'm not arguing your point. I'm not disputing your point at all.
Well, are there any, does anybody have any specific suggestions about how there might be some more notice about this? I mean, one of the challenges is that it's a little bit difficult.
In our household, we say heck, and there could be small children watching, given the composition of the board. So.
Okay.
So I think.
So anybody have any idea how the heck we can promote this
public? I think through maybe.
Keep at it, and the language is going to become even more colorful.
Alert neighborhood associations. Put more signs up on telephone poles.
And electronically get things out to neighborhood associations and the different. I'd use boards. I'd use some of the advisory boards to also filter through.
Yeah.
Carborough's newspaper could help us in getting the word out on it.
Yeah,
that might help.
An inaugural issue.
Okay, well,
we had this idea of signage that came up with the New Horizons thing. And, you know, that doesn't, I guess I mean to say signs. That doesn't have to just apply to suburban areas or, you know, where there's a big right-of-way besides a road. We have the ability to hang some signs around downtown where people could be directed to the website for information on a change coming up.
And we haven't forgotten that issue. We're still looking at that there. The Department of Transportation has gotten, and correct me if I'm wrong, Roy, has gotten a little more intense in their interest in signage on their rights of way, and in looking at some of the things out of the New Horizons Task Force, that's one of the issues that we've been dealing with is where we can do that. Not to say that we can't do something, but we have to be mindful of that.
Can we put placards in the buses announcing public hearings on things? I mean, we just heard about how great the bus ridership is. An awful lot of the people that are involved with downtown ride the buses. Could we put them in the buses? I know we can, but is there a way for us to put them in the buses?
Well, I don't know that we can. I mean, we're a partner, but it's not Carborough's system, and I don't know if the town of Chapel Hill has.
No, I mean there would be a cost to it. I know there's a cost to it because I've looked at that for other things.
It's pretty cheap.
But the cost is pretty cheap, and anybody. You know, who's not using bad words can put signage up there. So maybe we could. It is fairly cheap. We could put them on like the J route, the CW, and the F.
Yeah, we can talk to Chapel Hill Transit about how we might do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be a relatively inexpensive way to reach lots of folks.
Could you let me know next week how those conversations go?
I forget where we are.
It's been moved
and seconded to have a public hearing. So all those in favor of scheduling a public hearing, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously.
I need to make one tangential comment, not to you, Kendall, which is a few weeks ago I asked about things that get placed at our table, getting onto the website, attached to the agenda. And this updated comparison table is just the kind of thing where if a couple of weeks from now I was wanting to review this ordinance, I'd find the old version. I wouldn't find the new version in the agenda packet. And it's just important to have access to this kind of material in an ongoing basis. So I'm just saying that by way of encouraging you all to, you know, continue efforts to try and solve that issue.
We're working on it to try to figure out which pieces
really make sense to post and which, because you all get some things at your places that might not necessarily rise to the level of needing to be posted.
All right, thanks.
Mr. Manager, I'm sorry.
That's okay. All right. This is a report on the Ecosystem Enhancement Program's Best Management Practice Conceptual Plan for the Roberson and Carborough Track Site. Morgan Little Creek Local Watershed Planning Process led to the identification of a number of potential stormwater best management practice sites in the watershed. The North Carolina Ecosystem Enhancement Program, better known as EEP, conducted a feasibility study of two of the potential sites to determine if they would be cost-effective for the town to implement. The study was recently completed by EEP, and the results of the two sites have been summarized and will be presented by staff to the board tonight. And Will Autry, our environmental planner, at least for a little while longer, has a presentation. Will.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to say EEP because I never really liked the sound of EEP as we go forward, but anyway. I also have noted in reviewing these documents that you've received a little bit more carefully that there are a couple of discrepancies in the report from the Ecosystem Enhancement Program, as well as some discrepancies that I made when I took some information from the Jordan fiscal analysis. And so I'm going to make some corrections as I go through here and point them out for you. just a little background, the Wetlands Restoration Program in was established in 1997. In 2003, it became the EEP. The function really is to do mitigation for DOT projects. As it moved along, they added on doing offset BMPs for nutrient reduction for the Neuse and Tarpamlico nutrient-sensitive waters programs. And so the EEP is constantly searching for mitigation sites, both stream and wetland restoration and BMP sites. And as you probably all recall, through the Morgan Little Creek Watersheds Planning Initiative, which started in 2002, it was a stakeholder process in which the town staff was involved, as well as a number of citizens. And Tetra Tech completed a number of different reports from this. And in August of 2004, the Targeting of Management report identified a number of sites throughout the Morgan Little Creek watersheds in Orange County, Carborough, and Chapel Hill. And just as a reminder, these are stream restoration sites here, the kind of pink ones, and then the purple ones are watersheds draining to a darker purple best management practice or structural BMP. So in 2002, the town and EEP entered an MOU. Two things stated in the MOU were that EEP was going to do feasibility studies of any of the projects identified for pursuing those, and also that they were going to implement one project in the town's jurisdiction. In June of 2005, Dr. Rennell, a former environmental planner, made a presentation to this board and requested that you authorize the town to move forward with EEP on looking at the Carborough track site. And I'll look at this one more time and point out that this area right in here was the Carborough track site. And that selection was based on the EEP cost-benefit analysis and further staff review by Dr. Rennell and other planning staff. So the Carborough track site has a treatment watershed, and this is one of the errors I want to point out to you. The watershed size was listed as in a number of different ways in the EEP report, and the actual treatment watershed for the detention basin that was proposed was about 10 acres. It was a wet detention basin, and it is constrained by a substantial watershed size. Upstream land use is it's rather impervious, and the topography is steep enough such that the size dam gets very near requiring dam safety regulations. Once you build a dam over 15 feet, you have a whole different set of regulations, and the topography also causes access problems. Another issue was the fact that the soils have very shallow underlying bedrock, and therefore, even though you might dam up an area, you wouldn't be able to excavate to find the dirt for the dam, and therefore to to build a larger pool. So this turned out to be totally not cost-effective at all, just not even worth thinking about. But this was the site from the Morgan Little Creek plan. Cat's Cradle here for reference, and Brewer Landing, you're all familiar. The EEP report here zeroed in a little bit more, and they looked at three different dam locations in this general vicinity here. Again, this is the railroad track easement here. And this uppermost, here's your north area here, was the best one, which still was determined to be not even close to being cost-effective. The Carborough Track site, again, that was it. While they were looking at the Carborough Track site, they yielded another potential site nearby, which the EEP called the Roberson site. The treatment watershed there is going to be only about 4 acres. The actual project would be a pocket wetland of about a tenth of an acre. And it's constrained by the property boundaries, some existing utilities. There's a historic mill dam structure there in the Kudzu Patch. And then the topography on the north side is limiting as well. And the upstream watershed size of 25 acres makes it a little bit difficult, too. So this site, the yellow lines you see here were the identification of a potential stream restoration site by EEP. But they don't want to do stream restorations until we can slow the water down upstream, such as with the detention basin we just talked about that was too expensive. They don't want to fix the stream and then have it blow out again. So, but this little area right here where this stream and this drainage converge was the site that was investigated. you can see the stream A here down to this point has a 25-acre watershed, and stream B coming in here has about a 40-acre watershed. But this little hatched red area is the area that they were talking about treating. Now, you see this blue line is solid here, and then it's broken where it goes piped underground behind the townhomes here. And the reason I pointed out that the watershed was so large is that if you put this pocket wetland here, when you get large storm events, this pipe can't take all this water, and this water jumps above grade and would run down here and flood this. Same thing with this stream. Anything above a two-year storm event would flood this pocket wetland. So for the two-year storm event and below, which is most of your storms, and that's what we call the bankful event, this pocket wetland would have an efficient treatment for those 4 acres right there. But anything larger than that storm event and this stream are going to flood over and just flush everything through without appropriate treatment. So here's a closer look at it. Again, you can see the pipe here where this water is being piped underground now. This would be a bypass to push water into it to keep the wetland wet so that it wouldn't dry up. It's really important when you build these stormwater wetlands that they have enough flow in them during dry periods so that all the plants don't die. But it would be built with some different varying levels of depth and that sort of thing. So this turned out to be very expensive, $95,000. And here's one of the next things I wanted to point out of my errors here. That $95,000 I mentioned in either the memo or the agenda item abstract does not include design costs. It also doesn't include land costs. And so I just wanted to make that clear. So the $1,550 annual maintenance cost suggests it doesn't include treatment of all the kudzu. And for this to work effectively, you'd have to effectively manage the kudzu. A couple of other problems here, or opportunities in the future, I guess. The Ecosystem Enhancement Program basically gets mitigation credits for DOT projects from the Corps, the United States Army Corps of Engineers. And right now, the Corps doesn't give EEP credit for stream and wetland restorations, only gives credit for stream and wetland restorations, not for standalone BMPs. EEP's been working on that for a while and not really making a lot of headway with the Corps on changing that arrangement. Also, EEP receives offset payments in the new Centaur-Pamlico Basin to do nutrient-reducing BMPs, which these are that type, but they can't spend that money outside of those basins. So that's two strikes against this project. And I'll also point out here the EEP, that funding rate, that funding structure here, they take in 11 pounds of nitrogen per year for one of those offset payments in the noose or the tarpan, and 11 per tenth of a pound of phosphorus. That rate is so low that they, even in the noose and the tarpan basins, they can't really afford to build any BMPs like that because it costs so much more than that, and they can't pay, they can't buy, or excuse me, they can't have someone pay them for 10 pounds of nitrogen and only be able to afford to build something that takes care of 2 pounds. So they have this funding structure problem, which they was attempted to, someone attempted to address last year, and they upped it to $57 for nitrogen and $45 for phosphorus, which was immediately overturned and sent back for further study. I think maybe the development lobby might have had something to do with that, but anyway, that's still being studied. So hopefully in the next year or so that number will change, and if it turns out to be a true cost, it will probably be much higher than either one of those. For example, when you do this calculation backwards for the Roberson site, you come up with paying $265 a pound of nitrogen or $245 for a tenth of a pound of phosphorus. That's the kind of treatment cost we're talking about here. Now, this is relevant when you find out that there's no EEP funding available because of all these things, because it's too expensive, because the Corps won't give them credit for this kind of thing right now, and because the Corps won't, excuse me, because they can't, because their own rules do it outside of their basin. Did you have a question?
Well, could you just, I know you're kind of in the middle of this.
Please.
Still, but let me get some clarification. So, and at some point, it is proposed that it would become mandatory for us to do these type of things. Is that right?
That is correct.
To build these BMPs, or
we'll get to that in just a bit.
Okay. Okay. Well, why don't you get to that in just a bit? Then
sure.
That's fine.
So, for those three reasons, no one can help. EEP can't help pay for these. If we wanted to move forward with this Roberson site, you know, for $150,000, $200,000 plus ongoing maintenance, it would be for us to find funding through grant sources or other methods. But before talking about taking any action of what we might do with the Roberson site, I think it's important to look at the bigger picture. The Jordan rules are getting closer and closer. Last Thursday, Thursday the 8th, the Division of Water Quality made a presentation to the Environmental Management Commission, and the EMC approved setting up a public comment period for this, for these rules. And so the hope with the folks at the state is that the effective date of the rules is going to be July 1st, 2008. That's really the goal at this point, because as you can see, it's been dragging on for quite some time. I mean, really, we've been under the gun since 2002 when the Upper New Hope Arm was listed on the 303D list for chlorophyll A exceedances. But the lake has been considered a nutrient-sensitive water since the year it was impounded in 1983. So, you know, we're sort of going to be punished for a problem that we knew was going to happen when somebody else decided to build the lake. So, primary impacts in Carver of these Jordan rules are going to be new redevelopment will be subject to very strict nutrient limits. Much lower than the numbers in our area of the Upper New Hope Arm of Jordan Lake. These numbers will be far more strict than those in the Neuse and the Tarr-Pamlico basins now. And so we're already working on some stormwater ordinance revisions and including this, because we want to get ahead of the curve, because everything we do since 2001 is going to help us in the future. And that's because the town, so that first part will fall our developers, which ultimately falls on our citizens who have to buy, you know, houses or goods or whatever at the properties that are being developed. But the bigger issue for the town to consider, I think, is the existing development. So all of the acreage that is presently in the town's limits, we will be required to reduce our nitrogen exports by 35% from what was coming out in 2001, and our phosphorus by 5% of what's coming out in 2001. And I'll point this out, the Lower New Hope Arm has no net increases from the 2001 baseline. The reduction goals in the Hall are 8% for nitrogen and 5% for phosphorus, but we're the hardest hit, and with the 35% nitrogen reduction and the 5% phosphorus. And here's the little...
Why is that? Why would the goal be so different between the Upper New Hope Arm and the Haw?
For one, this road right here really causes the water in this upper area of the lake not to flow through and mix the way that it flows through in this portion of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of have almost like a mud puddle thing going on there, so that all the nutrients and stuff that wash off of the downtown Durham and Chapel Hill and Carrboro and that sort of stuff, and the stuff that's coming out from the city of Durham's and the county of Durham's wastewater plants and Owasso's wastewater plant. All those nutrients go into this area and just kind of hang out and do their thing instead of being flushed on through and assimilating in a way that they do more of down here. And we're closer. I mean, if you're Greensboro up here, you get the Hall River to treat for that many miles before you get to the lake. If you're us, when water goes out of Carrboro, it just has a little piece of Chapel Hill to get through before all of a sudden it's on the Coeur d'Alene and in Jordan Lake's, you know, flood limits. Did you have a question?
Well, if I could just stick with the topic for a minute. I mean, it strikes me, you know, not to pick on our neighbors who I think are trying to make the best decisions for their own communities, but I think this should bother us a lot. And, you know, for example, there are large areas of Alamance County that have no zoning at all. You know, there may have been a time when that was a good and reasonable decision for Alamance County to make, but where we've taken great strides to try and control the quality of water washing out of Southern Orange County, collectively the three governments have, that same level of effort's not been seen necessarily in all these other jurisdictions that drain into the same basic lake. And I realize it's not you that's making these decisions, but it, you know, I the notion that the goal should be a 35% reduction for the folks who've already done the most to protect the quality of water and to protect the quality of water that we don't even drink as a community and probably never will drink as a community just doesn't it doesn't sit very well. I guess another question I have is if this is actually adopted the way that it's proposed to be adopted here, and you're saying so it has two implications. One is that developers will have to meet a higher standard for basically their stormwater management practices. Will have to be they'll have to achieve at a higher level than they're required to achieve now. But also that we as a town will be responsible for essentially like a retrofit
of all of town,
right, of the water runoff and Chapel Hill will have to meet their goals, and will Orange County have to meet some goals as well for
everyone in that watershed.
So here's one question I have is about the way these rules will work. Will it be possible for Carrboro and Chapel Hill and Orange County to work on the problem collectively? Because for example, in the rural buffer, there might be more places, more physical space wherein ponds, wetlands, that type of thing, BMPs, whatever you want to call them, could be built.
Right. Well, I think I've heard two questions I want to try to answer, and then if you'll let me, Mr. Mayor, I'll move on, because some other questions that you've asked I'm going to touch on a little bit more.
Sure.
But one was, you know, what will we be – these aren't the only two things. These are the two most important things. There will also be some revisions to the buffer regulations. Agriculture will have other issues to concern with if we have contractors in our town who are doing landscaping services. They may be required to have nutrient application licensing and that sort of thing. So there are other issues, but these are the two biggest. And everyone in the whole watershed will have to deal with all of these. But you see, it's going to be hardest for us. That existing the other parts are more similar. The existing development part is the part that's going to be hardest for all of us in the Upper New Hope Arm. I am going to mention a little bit some other opportunities related to this, specifically to your question about can we share this load. So if you let me get back to that, we can talk about it a little bit more later. But the fiscal impact. The Division of Water Quality presented the fiscal analysis to the EMC when they made their presentation, and their estimations of the existing development costs for the watershed were going to be $403 million over the lifetime of making these reductions occur. Now, here's another place where I made an error. I did some numbers based on an acreage number in the report, which I carried through incorrectly. It was actually 200,000 or so of the acres in the watershed are in the existing development category of the entire watershed of 1 million acres. So there are some numbers in that memorandum to you that state that the estimation per capita would be about $12 million for the town, and the estimation per acreage would be about $8 million. That $8 million should actually be $2 million based on resulting from my error. But I want to remind you that that $2 million would be based on a treatment cost of $400 or so dollars per acre. And, for example, that Roberson site, which is, you know, admittedly a costly BMP, comes in at more like $23,000 plus. That's $23,000 before you pay for the land or the annual maintenance. So you know, that 400, even though I made a mistake, I still think that 8 was probably low to start with, but based on that. So
this is not my area of expertise, other tonight I don't know what is, but the only option is through BMPs for controlling the runoff. There is not the option of like very strict adherence to source reduction?
Well, no, the source reduction we're going to get credit for. I mean, the Division of Water Quality has been working with stakeholders through this past summer to talk about how we were going to deal with this existing development, because one of the things that happened was when they first presented to the Water Quality Committee of the EMC, it was slightly different than what the entire stakeholder process that went from 2003 to 2005 came out with. Mm-hmm. So the division presented something a little different, and some stakeholders were frustrated with that. And so the Water Quality Committee said, you guys need to go back and work with the stakeholders some more and sort some of these things out. So there are going to be some opportunities, such as if you do more street sweeping and you get more nitrogen and phosphorus off of the streets, then you'll get credit for that. You'll get a numerical credit that you'll be assigned for how many miles of street you sweep.
But how about for like reducing the usage?
The usage of
nitrate.
Well, like fertilizers and
yeah.
You know, again, those will be addressed sort of through the.
It's kind of like worrying about where you're going to put all your garbage without worrying about reducing the amount of garbage you generate.
That's the
same problem.
I think I should answer that by saying the big problem here is some people suspect that the big issue here is atmospheric deposition of nitrogen, that you can't, no matter whether or not you fertilize your yard, all the people driving around all the time, all the pollutants going out of their car and coming back down to earth, that's where a tremendous amount of the nitrogen that gets into the water column comes from. So we, you know, stopping people from fertilizing their lawn isn't going to really address that.
I still say it gets down to it's the same issue. It's figuring out where you're going to throw all the trash instead of lessening the amount of trash. It's
I agree. Well, and one of our neighbors in the New Hope Farm has raised this point about atmospheric deposition of nitrogen, yeah, and how much money the Division of Water Quality and the other stakeholders may be interested in putting into some enhanced monitoring equipment to check on those numbers. Because on the big picture idea here is this whole idea of 35% nitrogen reduction may be ludicrous. It may be impossible. It may not be technically feasible at all for decades to come.
Has anybody ever thought of taxing people at the source? So if people are creating this problem, then either when they bought fertilizer or when they bought a gallon of gas, they would be taxed for what it cost Carbro to get rid of it. Probably not,
but
something that would go past the General Assembly, so I'll just shut up. Yeah, that's
the whole thing.
But
we'll see.
I had a question just going back to Mark's comment about the disparity. And this I don't really mean to take away from your, the rest of your presentation.
I'm here
but
for
is
you.
There is I hope I wish you were here longer.
a couple weeks.
Yeah, right. But you know, is there any recourse as a municipality to address the concerns for the disparity, because it's water flows downstream. We're it's not. I mean, it's nice that we are doing, going to be doing our part plus
theirs.
For everyone, plus right. theirs for everyone who's downstream of us. But the question is, Alamance County and Guilford County, they're all huge.
Right.
And so is there any recourse?
Well, reminds me of the question that the mayor asked. And let me point out this one last thing here.
Yeah.
My guess, based on those, that $12 million per resident kind of thing, and understanding that if you spread that $403 million across all three watersheds, the Upper New Hope is going to pay a much higher rate per acre, per person, or however you want to look at it in that area. So I think we're looking at well over that amount. The good news is we get to submit to the Division of Water Quality a management strategy, a reduction strategy, that could, within reason, extend that cost out over a large number of years. So it will need to be approved by them. But anyway, so the Jordan Trading Study, Alderman Hagan O'Donnell and Mr. Mayor, I wanted to mention to answer your question. The Cape Fear River Assembly got some grant money from the EPA, and CH2M Hill has been contracted by them, and I've been attending meetings of this group, the stakeholder group, talking about the possibility of implementing a trading strategy here where, we might buy water quality credits and trade water quality credits back and forth, so that if, for example, the easiest case to consider and see, conceptually is if Owassa has a permit limit that says they can discharge, 10 million pounds of what, 1 million pounds of nitrogen a year, whatever the number is. And they're only using 60% capacity right now, so they're only up to 600,000. Then maybe they have 400,000 pounds of nitrogen they can sell to someone else as part of achieving their strategy. And so these things could be bought and sold more or less, and for indefinitely or for limited time frames and those sorts of things. So the Division of Water Quality has been working with us, with the stakeholders and with the Cape Fear River Assembly on this. And so the Jordan Trading Study is an opportunity for us. Actually, comically, you think that this would be so much harder for an urban municipality than, I believe you mentioned, the open space, for example, west of here in our Orange County area. If you have 10 acres of open space in Orange County that's only contributing this much nitrogen to start with, getting a 35% reduction of that is harder maybe than getting a 35% reduction of this. Maybe we might be, because we're closest to the lake with this hardest burden because of this dense urban impervious downtown, the opportunities for achieving those reductions may end up being, in that sense, only in that sense, a little easier than in some of the areas where the export rates are lower already. So that's maybe a silver lining in there. But, I put this slide up here because I wanted to point out the consideration for this particular Roberson site EEP project or EEP feasibility study, and how it relates to this larger picture, and that these other things are still going on out there. The Bowling Creek Watershed Restoration Team, we're moving forward. With your action earlier with the consent agenda, we may have a contract signed by the end of the week with our preferred contractor, and hopefully you'll have a report in August for the geomorphic analysis of the watershed. The Jordan Trading Study we've been actively pursuing, and the town staff has participated as a part of a pilot watershed, which also means that the Cape Fear River Assembly may be interested in spending some money in Carborough to build a BMP here. We're hoping that may come to fruition. We'll see how that goes. And then EEP still sort of owes us a project based on the MOU, depending on their need, and there's plenty of language to alleviate them of that responsibility, I guess, if necessary. But I believe they're still actively seeking opportunities here as well. So So the training study is probably the biggest the biggest opportunity for us to share this load and to try to help other municipalities and local governments. And
As it's being studied or as it's imagined so far, would for the Jordan trading study, is the notion that the trading would go on throughout the Jordan Lake watershed, or that there would be sort of individual markets for the Upper New Hope Arm versus?
It looks like we're probably going to be talking about three different markets, because the rates will just be so different in the Upper New Hope as compared to Greensboro or Reedsville or something. You know, it's just such a larger area that we'll probably be talking about trading between Owosso and Durham and Durham County and Chapel Hill and Carrboro and Orange County and that kind of thing. In conclusion, this is a really important issue. It's getting closer and closer. You've been aware of it for some time, but it's really, really coming to the last stretch here. And so we have requested that this topic be added to the agenda for the Assembly of Governments meeting. Today, we still don't know if that's going to work out or not. I hope that it is. And if so, the speaker who would be making that presentation to you and answering your questions has been involved with the stakeholder process since 2002, yes, 2003, from the very beginning of the process, actually kind of ran, the meetings. And so it's probably much more well-equipped to answer your questions than me with his history. So we hope that that's going to happen. And based on that, I recommend that this board take some time to consider the information that you receive at that time and, then look into this Roberson site and possibly other projects, kind of as part of a larger strategy of how we're really going to go about this, because this, as far as stormwater quality goes, and the BCWRT thing fits right into this, but as far as this stormwater goes for the town, this is really going to be the driving thing for the next couple of decades.
Now, I hate to belabor this topic. It is getting kind of late, but I want to understand it just a little better. It's partly about creating these BMPs, as you call them, basically ponds or artificial wetlands. That's kind of what they are. They capture, they slow the water down and then capture some of the pollutants that are in the water, basically. Act as like a filter, a natural filter or whatever. And Jackie asked you about reducing the sources of the pollution, and I think you said that some possible strategies for reducing some of the pollution or other methods of collecting out the pollution, like increased street sweeping or whatever, there would be a method for getting credit for that. Are there basically types of land uses, like existing land uses, that could be taken away? That, in other words, for example, are junkyards or something like that particularly bad offenders from the perspective of the kind of nutrients that are implicated here, or is it more like big parking lots?
It's just more like streets? Impervious area in general. The phosphorus is more tied to the earth. So, if you have land disturbing activity or farming activities, then you might have some more phosphorus release. But the nitrogen, a lot of studies from recent studies from NC State really show that a lot of that's coming off of rooftops and parking lots in atmospheric deposition, and then get the rain on the shingles pushes it on down into the creek, and that's where a lot of it in the water column's coming from.
Okay. Yeah, I have two questions. You said that the BMP for Roberson would accommodate a 2-year storm threshold. Mm-hmm. If there's a larger storm, do we lose that BMP? Does the improvement get washed out by that storm, and are we back to where we were?
No. The The system will work by plants in the pocket wetland assimilating the nutrients.
Okay. And they would
and some of them will be harvested from time to time. I mean, that'll be part of the ongoing maintenance. Mm-hmm. But it would just wash through. It just means you won't get to treat it because it's more water than you could treat at one time.
Okay, I see. My other question is, so we have, if the regulations are adopted July 08, and we then have 4 years, essentially, to initiate a plan to achieve, presumably, that 35% reduction, how long is the time frame during that plan can be in effect to achieve that result? Do you know?
Well, I would like to clarify that within 3 years of the effective date, the town gets to talk about it amongst ourselves, think about what we're going to do, and by the end of 36 months, we have to submit to the Division of Water Quality our plan.
Right.
They'll review that and get it back to us within a year, and we do start then with 48 months after. Now, as I mentioned before, and the idea here is that we get to say in the plan we're going to do this over 10 years or 5 years or 20 years or 50 years or whatever, you know, and as long as it passes the reasonableness test with the Division of Water Quality, they'll approve our strategy. Another thing to keep in mind, which I'm sure that if you get this presentation in a couple of weeks, you'll hear more about this, but the stakeholders have encouraged the Division of Water Quality to implement these rules with the with an adaptive management strategy component. There's a lot of question and concern about the validity of the measurements that led to this chlorophyll A exceedance, whether or not the a lot of detailed questions and some questionable science, according to some out there, about, you know, why we're in this whole mess to start with. And so the stakeholders have proposed that these rules have this adaptive management strategy in place, and that the model that was used to get us to here, we're going to continue to upgrade and calibrate and validate the model over and over as we move forward. And if in 5 years from now it turns out that, you know, it wasn't as bad as we thought, maybe we need to achieve a 25% reduction, then the rules will be changed to allow for that. But on the other hand, if it turns out that it's worse, that's a realistic consideration as well.
So that term you used, reasonable, we don't really know what that means.
No, we don't know what that means.
Well,
at so many levels.
I was just saying, I mean, on the surface level of this, no pun intended, you know, it certainly seems like, you know, the goal is to balance it on the back of a wealthier county, you know. That's what it looks like. I'm just throwing that out there because
it's about proximity. They built a lake downstream of Durham, Chapel Hill, and Carborough, you know, long after we were here. And a lot of people knew there were going to be problems when they built it.
Oh, yeah.
So
some of us remember that.
Any other questions? So as I mentioned, the recommendation is to receive the report and consider this Robertson site in the larger context after you've heard more information about the Jordan regulations.
The resolution is presented.
Second.
Mr. Manager, did you have a...
I just want to say, you know, an even bigger issue, and part of why we wanted to try to add someone into the Assembly of Governments is the issue a couple of you all have raised is about the appropriateness and the equity involved in this, and whether or not, at least in the beginning, to have conversations with the local governments in Orange County about getting with some of the other jurisdictions and saying, hey, wait a minute. I mean, I'm not sure this is the point where we simply have to sit back and accept that these percentages have to be this. In fact, I don't think we should. And so I think we need to start those conversations and try to get some support, first of all, in Orange County, and try to extend that to see what kind of flexibility there might be and say, hey, wait a minute, we've been doing a really good job in our communities with this, and now we're being asked to carry what seems to be an unfair part of the burden to fix a problem for somebody else. So to me, that's kind of the first step, because these numbers that Will has thrown out, I mean, would sink us if we had to do it over the next 10 or 15 years.
I don't disagree with the manager. I would also point out, however, that in conversations with other folks in the New Hope Arm, with the Division of Water Quality, with TJ Cox staff who have been attending all these meetings, it's also been pointed out that it's in our best interest to work this out with the Division of Water Quality rather than bucking with them so much that we're then all stuck dealing with the EPA, because it will be even harder to do to accomplish this TMDL with the EPA, most likely, than it is to accomplish the nutrient management strategy that's on the table. Either way, it's overwhelming.
Well, and I think one question that might be worth considering is, I mean, 2001 is meant to be the baseline year that we're measuring against, and I guess, you know, part of the issue is fundamentally that it's harder for us to make progress because we got started and did a lot of the easier and actually not so easy things to do about these issues, you know, whatever, 10, 20 years before that. And so I think one question we might want to ask is 2001 really a fair baseline year to be operating off of?
Right. Not
It's based on sampling events in the lake.
I'm sure, but you guys love modeling.
Do you know the sign for not it?
All right. Thanks very much, Will, for your report on this. This has been definitely really helpful in better understanding this whole issue, I think, for this board. And I know I speak for all of us in saying we really appreciate all the work you've done for the town of Carrboro.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. All those in favor of receiving the report, see if I'm saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. Mr. Manager, item D5.
Okay. D5 is discussion of possible revisions to the draft ordinance to establish a six-month moratorium on development projects in the Northern Study Area. On February 20th, the board set a public hearing to receive public comment on a draft ordinance which would establish a six-month moratorium on rezonings and special and conditional use permit applications for residential development. Board members have expressed an interest in modifying the effective date of the ordinance, and a resolution providing an opportunity to specify any follow-up has been prepared and is in your packet. And Trish McGuire, Planning Administrator, is before you to share with you some of those potential revisions. Trish.
Thank you, Steve. Good evening, everyone. I really just have a few comments to make, and this is an opportunity for you all to discuss the draft ordinance that is going to public hearing next week. As the ordinance is currently drafted, the effective date is based on when the Board of County Commissioners makes their approval, approves the ordinance following your public hearing and adoption of the draft ordinance. And the Board of County Commissioners has indicated they will receive public comment on April 26th at the Joint Planning Public Hearing, and so that they would take action regarding this draft ordinance following that that public hearing. Their next meeting after April 26th is May 3rd, I believe. Just to recap what's in your packet, the Northern Study Area is about 3,787 acres total. 1,400 acres approximately of that area are within our complete jurisdiction, and they are the areas within this dashed line, essentially. And then the remaining acres are in Orange County's jurisdiction. And so are ours to plan for and permit per the terms of the joint planning agreement. It's just a summary of the issues that are associated with deciding on, changing the effective date and so forth for your consideration. The controlling instruments for our actions are the general statutes. There is no specified time frame for the end of the development moratorium. Of course, we've drafted a moratorium per the real controlling instrument for us, which is the joint planning agreement, because so much of this area is within that joint planning area. It does have terms. The joint planning agreement does spell out terms for the for a development moratorium, where it's initially 6 months with a maximum 6-month extension. The adoption per the statutes for a moratorium in any other case would be the board, and then in this case it is the Board of Aldermen with the Board of County Commissioners approving subsequent to your action. And we just did an estimate of areas that are amount of land that's undeveloped. This is a very rough number based on just looking at GIS parcels, and it's not scientific in that sense. It's just a real kind of overview. of that, and I've already stated that. Our recommendation is that if you review the have reviewed the materials we've provided to you and have would like to consider making any changes to the draft ordinance so that when we do prepare the packets before the hearing later this week, that the draft ordinance reflects those
Alex.
Changes.
And then, just one item, which is actually fairly major, and that's a pun, and you'll find out why in a minute. When we previously discussed the scope of this, my understanding was that we had agreed that this was going to apply to major residential subdivisions only and not minors or staff reviews.
That's correct.
Well, it doesn't say that. All it says is that it applies to all CUPs and SUPs.
Right. Well, it applies to rezonings and then
any... Right, rezonings and all CUPs and SUPs. Now, there are instances where SUPs can be minors, right?
I don't believe so.
12 or fewer units.
Anything that goes to the Board of Adjustment or the Board of Aldermen is a major subdivision.
Okay.
The staff only reviews minor subdivisions. Minor subdivisions is four or
that's
less.
Right. Yeah, I forgot that we changed that. Okay, then I'm correct. Then I stand corrected. Okay. I just want to make sure about that.
Yeah, I read over this material and I don't see that there's any benefit in changing the schedule or dividing the moratoriums as is the option. So I think we should stick with what we got unless someone has some further point.
I think I inadvertently raised this question by this whole topic or big part of this topic by asking the question, what would happen if Carrboro adopted the moratorium and the county did not? The way it's worded now, if Carrboro adopts it and the county does not, then there's no moratorium in either area. Is that right?
That's correct.
So that's my only concern is...
But if you look at the map and you look at the area that we would actually be able to control the moratorium in, I don't think...
Like, who cares?
Basically. Yeah, exactly. I don't think we would even be talking about a moratorium for that area otherwise.
Yeah. Okay.
I understand your concern. I'd recommend that we just cross that bridge when we get to it if we have an issue and then just work it out with the county.
That's fine. All right. So unless you all disagree down at the left end of the table, then I think we're going to move on to item six.
Item six is additional appointments to the Northern Study Area Plan Implementation Review Committee. At your meeting on March 6th, you established the Implementation Review Committee, made a number of appointments. You're asked to consider additional appointments to the Advisory Board and, as available, other community members to serve on the committee.
Mark? It occurs to me that our action on item seven might, if we did that first, affect our action on item six, given that we have a common applicant.
Somebody applied for both.
For both, and that we might do well. I mean, assuming, which I assume, that the sense of the board is that we're going to appoint Sharon Cook to the planning board, that we should do that, and then we might not want to consider her for the other, but at least, we'd have that context, correct?
Okay, if it's agreeable to everyone, we'll switch the order of six and seven. We're on planning board appointments. Does anybody have a motion?
The appointment is recommended by the chair of the planning board.
Which is Sharon Cook.
Sharon.
It's been moved and seconded that we appoint Sharon Cook to the planning board. All those, unless there's any comment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, and it passes unanimously. We are on the NSA Plan Implementation Review Committee. Amy, let me just point out that Amy Drolleman lives in the part of this study area that's currently unincorporated Orange County, which I thought was notable. I think she might end up be one of very few people on this committee. If she's appointed, there should be one of very few people on this committee who doesn't already live in the town of Carrboro. So that seems like a perspective that's worth having.
Mm-hmm. I'm not clear on how many we're being asked to appoint.
We created three spots. So we could potentially appoint all three of these applicants. We did just appoint Sharon Cook to the...
And we don't have people serve on two major things. We kind of have them.
Well, I have our policy before us. It says that you can only serve on one board of the following boards, and it lists all our standing boards and commissions, basically. So there's nothing in these rules, as far as I can determine, that would disallow somebody from being on both one of our standing boards and a sort of ad hoc committee.
Yeah, I mean, I would also remind people that it is a frequent practice to make sure that we have representation from our standing advisory boards on these ad hoc groups, because there's some cross-pollination in developing these issues, and if there's representation from the advisory boards on these groups, then that often helps develop the product more quickly than...
Which right. We have.
Yeah.
In fact, we have two members of the planning board on the NSA PERC already.
My concern would be that other advisory board members might have assumed that they couldn't apply for an at-large seat since they weren't designated. So there's more a question of fairness in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And sensible.
And the meetings are open, is that right?
Yeah, the meetings are open. I'm not going to be the chair of the committee, but I did chair the first meeting until we get a fuller panel of members. And we tried, everybody who came was welcome basically to participate in the meeting, whether they were on the committee or not.
Why don't we just do this for right now then, because I'm going to blow out this door in about 30 seconds. So
Make a motion.
I'll move that we appoint Amy and Jim, and we'll just hold that third seat open until we talk about it some more.
All right.
And Jay Bryan, do we need to include him?
Jay's
is he already appointed?
Jay's already on there.
Well, he's been recommended by the...
So let's just put Bryan in there for good measure.
Sure.
Okay. It says that the Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee is to select their own member, but anyway... in any case, Jay, it's been moved and I think seconded at this point. Who seconded it?
Second.
That Jim Rabinowitz, Amy Drollman, and Jay Bryan are appointed to the seats, and we're leaving open for the moment. I have one more at-large seat. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. I think that's grand. Are there any... That's it, right? We're done.
Tip-offs in five minutes.
Amazing how that works. Are there any matters from the staff?
One item, just to remind everyone that Senator Kinnaird and Senator Cowell are sponsoring the Sharon Harris Fire Safety event at Big Barn at Barrington Thursday at 7, and our presence is encouraged and our support is needed to those efforts. So hope as many of us as possible can get down there with.
And I would like to recognize Jackie Helvey's recognition in the News and Observer today as for Women in History Week. Our Carbro's own Jackie Helvey, Volunteer of the Year, was highlighted. So congratulations, Jackie.
And Farmers Market opens Saturday.
All right.
Yep.
That sounds good.
Second.
Then moving to second, we adjourn. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.